From BDWPS.com and BDWPS Podcasts, this is Year of the Bowie, an 8-episode podcast series that tells the story of David Bowie. I'm your host, Andy. If you haven't listened to the first 4 episodes yet, I would recommend giving them a listen before proceeding with today's show. If you like what you hear on this month's episode, I would love if you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search Year of the Bowie. Now let's get back to the story of David Bowie. A reoccurring theme up to this point in our Year of the Bowie series has been that David Bowie was always a bit full of himself. It goes all the way back to his days at Bromley Tech. However, I would argue that most people who are as successful as David Bowie have some level of confidence in their talents. At the height of Ziggy Stardust mania, Bowie certainly had a lot to be cocky about, but some of his moves during this time showed that he was more than just an egomaniac. Mott the Hoople, an English rock band that had modest success as a cult band in the late 60s, found themselves on the verge of a breakup in 1972. When Bowie read about the rumors of a Hoople breakup, a band he happened to be a big fan of, he sat down and wrote a song for the band entitled All the Young Dudes in an Hour, and he scheduled a meeting with the band later that week. Here's guitarist Ian Hunter discussing the importance of that meeting.
And we were selling out everywhere over here, but BBC and the radio was closed to us because we'd had a couple of stiff singles. Wasn't happening. Mm. And so we decided to split up. And when we got back to London, Pete Watts, the bass player from Mott, rang up David for a gig, you know, because David was just starting to make a move. And David turned out to be a fan and said, you can't split up. And he offered us Suffragette City, which we didn't think would do it. It's okay, you know. But then when he played as Dudes, it was like, ye gods, you know, why are you giving this away? And this is a hit. And I'm a peculiar singer. It was a song I could handle. I knew straight away. It's a fabulous thing when you're behind a hit and nobody else has ever heard it. And you just knew that was a big one, yeah.
A few months later, Mott the Hoople would have their biggest hit song and a career that continued for another 4 years. It was indeed, as Hunter called it, a big one. Bowie would also help his fallen hero Iggy Pop, getting him and the Stooges signed to Main Man Records and flying him to London to work on music for the Stooges' 3rd album, Raw Power. After recording the album later that year, the label asked Bowie to try to soften some of the harsh mixes. Bowie's impact can best be heard on Give Me Danger.
Give me danger, little stranger, and I'll give you a piece. Give me danger, little stranger, and I'll heal your disease. There's nothing in my dream, just some ugly memories. Kiss me like the ocean breeze.
Lou Reed also happened to be living in London in 1972 with his then-girlfriend Betty Cronston. While his first encounter with Bowie a year earlier in New York City had been a bit of a cold interaction, Reed still remembered the starry-eyed Bowie saying he'd like to work with him someday. Seeing that Bowie was now a big star, Reed decided to take him up on the offer. Here's David talking about the excitement he had when asked to work on Reed's album, Transformer.
The thing is with Lou, he was so generous to work with. I mean, I was petrified that he said yes, he would like to sort of work with me in the producer capacity, because I had so many ideas and I felt so intimidated by my knowledge of the work that he'd already done. It felt impertinent of me to kind of recommend that we do things in certain styles and certain ways, but he just gave the whole project over to me, and I really hoped that I wouldn't let him down. You know, I really wanted it to work for him and be a memorable album that people wouldn't forget.
Sessions for the album Transformer were stressful for everyone involved due to the battling egos and creative energy between Reed and Bowie. Mick Ronson helped ease the tensions between the two, and his guitar flourishes can be heard throughout the album. David pushed Reed toward writing songs that captured what it was like to be a New Yorker. And the result is an album that is quintessentially New York City. Most notably, Lou Reed's most successful song, Walk on the Wild Side.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked her way across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way. Shaved her legs and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side.
The album would also feature Reed classics like Perfect Day, a romance song about drug addiction, Vicious, a sleazy glam rocker, and Satellite of Love, a song that features Bowie's voice in the outro, a soaring falsetto that brings the classic track to a powerful finish. It's a must hear. Listen for yourself.
Satellite of love.
I've always said that Transformer is my favorite Lou Reed album, but a friend of mine insists that it's more of a David Bowie album than a Reed album. He has a point, considering that Bowie's fingerprints are all over the project. Here's David talking about what is arguably Lou Reed's greatest work.
I think, looking back on them, of course, they're all such memorable, well-crafted and well-written pieces of work. It's almost like, there we are. I mean, there are so many songs on here that should and could have been, and probably will be one day, singles by other bands.
After finishing up work on Transformer, manager Tony DeFries made plans for Bowie to make a big splash in the United States. Since Bowie had acquired a fear of air travel, DeFries booked him and Angie on the Queen Elizabeth II, a cruise ship that sailed them to New York City, where they were greeted by press and RCA executives. Upon arrival, the couple checked in at the Sherry Netherland Hotel and got right to work, auditioning keyboard players for the American tour. Mike Garson, a jazz musician, would land the gig. This is important to note because Garson's piano playing style would have a huge impact on Bowie's upcoming project, Aladdin Sane. Here's Garson talking about the working relationship him and Bowie would share for the next three decades.
I was hired for 8 weeks and I ended up with him all those years. And I think that's because our creative processes were similar. It's kind of like you look for the notes that you're going to write or compose or play. Or if you can't do that, hopefully the notes find you.
Oh, okay.
So there's a little of that going on, and I think we shared that spirituality where you kind of surrender and you have an openness that it'll really work out.
Bowie's United States tour started out tepid, with less than stellar crowds in St. Louis and Cleveland. But as the weeks passed, venues began to fill up more and more, culminating in two sold-out shows at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium in Los Angeles. Those two shows have gained such esteem as a turning point in Bowie's success in the U.S. that a live version of the show was released in 2008, entitled Santa Monica 72.
Hi, this is B. Mitchell Reed along with Richard Kimball from the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. And the house lights are about to go down for the appearance of David Bowie.
Bowie lived the life of a rock star on that tour, dabbling more and more into cocaine use and engaging in sexual exploits throughout. Cynthia McCradu, a Bowie groupie at the time, said of Bowie on the tour, quote, "David was fucked up into the frenzy of everybody wanting to have sex with him, in the limo, on the way to the recording studio, on the sidewalk in front of the hotel, in the bathroom. Everywhere he turned, everybody wanted to have sex with him, and he was enjoying that." One legendary story from that tour tells of David attending a party at DJ Wolfman Jack's house. At the party, he took a girl he met to the bathroom and began to have sex with her. Two drag queens, unhappy with Bowie's choice of hetero sex, began banging on the door with their high-heeled shoes, yelling, quote, "Whatever she's doing, we can do it better. Let us in. Throw the bitch out." I'm quoting that. I did not make that up. Well, despite the fact that his marriage with Angie was based around the tenets of an open marriage, she still had trouble dealing with his exploits. Angie herself was not monogamous, but the idea of her husband gallivanting all over the United States with men and women didn't sit very well with her either. In January of 1973, Bowie returned to Trident Studios in London to start recording Aladdin Sane, an album that exudes the sleazy excess that took place on his U.S. tour. Album opener Watch That Man tells the story of a party gone awry, the narrator wasted and jaded by his surroundings. While Aladdin Sane is considered a Bowie classic, it lacks the fragility and compassion found in Hunky Dory and Ziggy Stardust. This intimacy was replaced by a dejected, destructive persona. This can be best seen on Cracked Actors, a song that drips with West Coast decadence and debauchery. Bowie would later say of Aladdin Sane, quote, "The Ziggy Stardust's album told the whole story. There was nothing more to say. And I knew when I was making Aladdin Sane that the bottom had just fallen out of the whole idea. He's even said in interviews that he considers the album to be a bit of a sellout album. It lacked the artistic integrity of the works that came before it. Despite Bowie's pessimism of the project, Aladdin Sane, released in April of 1973, would be the biggest advance hit in UK chart history, debuting at number one and cracking the US top 20. Over the next year, Bowie would tour the world, taking his Ziggy persona from the UK to the US to Japan. It was during his time in Japan that Bowie was informed that the Stooges had been dropped from Main Man Records by DeFreeze due to the band's continued self-destructive nature. Bowie disagreed with the decision, but began to realize that he may not have as much control in the record label as he once thought. The Spiders would return to England for another round of tour dates later that year, but ticket sales were beginning to wane. With the band beginning to complain about their pay and exhaustion from all the sex and partying, Bowie decided it was time to retire Ziggy Stardust. It was decided that the band's last show would be on July 5th at the Hammersmith Odeon. Bowie only told Ronson of the decision, so you can imagine the rest of the band's surprise when David announced during the concert that this was the band's last show.
Everybody, this is me. The one of the greatest tours of our life. We really... of all the shows on this tour, this particular show will remain with us the longest, because not only is it the last show of the tour, but it's the last show that we'll ever do. Thank you.
A week later, Bowie and Ronson flew to France to record Pinups, an album of cover songs, paying respect to all of David's influences. The album seemed to bring closure to the turbulent past 2 years. On the album, he'd cover artists ranging from The Kinks, The Who, and one of his all-time favorites, Pink Floyd. Here's a taste of his cover of Pink Floyd's See Emily Play.
Emily tries, but misunderstands. She's often inclined to borrow somebody's dreams till tomorrow.
Bowie's cocaine use was only rivaled by his creative output during that time. In a way, the drug helped the one-time shy boy from Brixton to untie his tongue and step out from the shadows. Here's Visconti discussing Bowie's reliance on cocaine.
It was the 70s. People were using cocaine thinking that it wasn't a bad drug. Honestly, that was the word on the street, so we were all sucked into that. I was worried for his health. He was very, very thin. His face was as white as a sheet of paper. And he was scary looking, but damn it, he'd go in front of the microphone and he sang beautifully.
Another major influence on Bowie's creativity at this time was a meeting he had with author William S. Burroughs early in 1973. Bowie, who had been a fan of Burroughs' work since his early days of beat poet admiration, spent the entire dinner culling the author's mind on his creative process. It was at this dinner that David was introduced to the Burroughs, quote, cut-and-paste style of writing. Here's band member Carlos Alomar, Bowie, and producer Brian Eno discussing this technique.
He would basically cut out words from an article, from a newspaper, from a book, wherever.
I tried doing it with diaries and things. I've used this method only on a couple of actual songs. What I've used it for more than anything else is igniting anything that might be in my imagination.
It's not because you're short of ideas necessarily, it's because it puts you into territories that you wouldn't otherwise get into. You wouldn't be led there by your own taste.
I'm just a sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania.
That same year, the glam rock-inspired cult classic film Rocky Horror Picture Show was gaining attention worldwide. Bowie's influence on the film's style and music is pretty evident. But in a way, the film inspired him to re-explore the world of theater that he'd always loved. Through his Burroughs-inspired creative process, Bowie came up with the idea to do a musical adaptation of George Orwell's 1984. Before he knew it, he had 22 songs for his epic stage production. Unfortunately, Main Man Records was unable to secure the rights from Orwell's widow. Here's Visconti talking about Bowie's ability to adapt.
David will always start a project with this idea, and it will grow and it will evolve, and it'll always end up to be something bigger or maybe a little bit different.
As a result, Bowie took his ideas in a similar direction, based around the idea of a group of teen punks named the Diamond Dogs. They lived on the roofs in a dystopian, post-apocalyptic world. Once again, he'd take on a persona, this time as Halloween Jack, an eye-patch-wearing, swaggering rebel leader to the street gang. For the first time, Bowie would perform and produce the majority of the album by himself. The result is Bowie's most brutal and bleak album since The Man Who Sold the World. On the album, Bowie took a new vocal approach, best described by biographer Mark Spitz as, quote, a crooning coke lizard basso profundo. This new sultry bravado is best seen on Sweet Thing.
Like a portrait in flesh, trails on a leash. Will you see that I'm scared and I'm lonely? So I break up my room and yawn and I run to the center of things. But knowing what you say,
boys, 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 it's a thing.
The hit single from Diamond Dogs would be Rebel Rebel, and is today considered Bowie's last great glitter song. We'll be right back. The main intent behind the creation of Diamond Dogs had been the theatrical stage production that David wanted to perform on tour. To help bring his vision to light, no expenses were too high for Main Man Records. Acclaimed choreographer Tony Basil, Tony Award-winning light designer Jules Fisher, and set designer Mark Ravitz were added to the payroll. Here's Tony Basil describing the amount of money being spent on the stage show.
When I was taken to dinner, David wasn't there, but there were several people with us, and the money that was being thrown around was a lot of money.
Ravitz was tasked to create an urban landscape for the stage that would be torn down and transported from city to city. The set would even contain a bridge that would rise and fall during the performance, and a backdrop of silk-screened skyscrapers that would slowly begin dripping blood during the show. Needless to say, it was an over-the-top production that still has impact on large-scale music concerts today, whether it be Lady Gaga performing in a castle, Kanye West rapping on top of a pyramid, or Pink executing Cirque du Soleil moves on the high wire. Here's Tony Basil talking about the impact of Bowie's Diamond Dogs tour.
He was just willing to do theater, rock and roll, dance, story, everything.
The first leg of Bowie's tour culminated in two sold-out shows at Madison Square Garden in New York City. Through word of mouth, the tour had so far been a huge success in terms of ticket sales. However, the cost of production alone resulted in a lack of funds after playing 28 shows in 26 nights. Here, band members Mike Garson and Carlos Alomar talk about the monetary struggles.
It was very expensive. I can't see how they could have made a penny. I just think money was just going, going, going.
What he was focusing on at that particular time was his creative flow. David is a hands-on person on a creative level. But when it came to the business, I'm not quite sure if David was really involved.
Bowie realized that he couldn't continue with the current stage show for the second leg of the tour, and he decided to make some major changes. For starters, the Diamond Dog Tour had been renamed the Philly Dog Tour, an homage to the marquee soul hit that you're listening to right now. Sold-out crowds expecting to see the complex stage show were shocked to see a different David Bowie. Hair slicked back, wearing a leisure suit, and carrying a cane. His new persona was known as the Thin White Duke. The new look was inspired by Bowie's experience in New York City during his month off between tours, specifically his free time spent in Harlem watching R&B shows and observing the wild styles worn on the streets. Here's backup singer Robin Clark discussing Bowie's new soulful direction.
Soul music and R&B music definitely had a big influence for him growing up in England. So this was just a natural process to become involved with, you know, musicians of color.
During that same break from touring, Bowie began working on his new album, Young Americans, which also happened to be influenced by his Harlem experiences. He called his new sound Plastic Soul.
Plastic Soul just purely comes out of his sense of humor, poking fun at, hey, look at me, I can do it too. And I'm not black, I'm not a soul brother. But he managed to capture what it was he needed to capture.
He brought in African-American singers to back him up, including his girlfriend on the side, Ava Cherry, and a young, shy Luther Vandross. Vandross wasn't actually meant to be on the album originally. In fact, he was in the studio one day simply to visit his old friend, guitarist Carlos Alomar. As Alomar played some of the tracks for his old high school buddy, Vandross said he felt the song Young Americans needed a specific backup harmony. Bowie happened to be lurking in the back of the room, and he asked Vandross to step behind the mic and show him what he envisioned for the song. The rest, as they say, is history.
Slinky back.
Vandross would go on to have a successful solo career, selling 35 million records worldwide and winning 8 Grammys. But it's a little known fact that he got his start due to a chance encounter with David Bowie. Here's Vandross discussing that career-changing moment.
I said, that sounds really good. I said, but it needs like a hook phrase or something, you know, that something that makes you want to come in and sing it. Something like, young Americans, young Americans. Young Americans, and David heard me do that. And he says, that's just what we need. And I ended up arranging all the vocals on the whole album. And he took me on the road.
David knew talent when he saw it, and he encouraged Vandross to contribute suggestions throughout the recording process. So much so that Bowie even included a song written by the young soul singer entitled Fascination. Here's a taste. During the second leg of the tour, filmmaker Alan Yentob was allowed to follow Bowie around for the BBC documentary Cracked Actors. The film illuminates Bowie's addiction to cocaine at that time. An 85-pound, emaciated man with a gaunt face, rambling to both the camera and to himself.
Well, I didn't know. I mean, when you're that mixed up, and I've been mixed up, man. I mean, really, it was, one doesn't know. One half of me is putting a concept forward and the other half is trying to sort out my own emotions. And a lot of my space creations are in fact facets of me I have now since discovered. But I wouldn't even admit that to myself at the time. That I would put everything, just make everything a little kind of upfront personification of how I felt about things.
Here's director Yentob discussing the Bowie he knew during filmmaking.
His diet often at the time was cocaine and milk, so it was sort of pure white experience.
There's a fly floating around in my milk, and he's a foreign body in it, you see, and he's getting a lot of milk. That's kind of how I felt.
When the tour finished in December, Bowie appeared on the Dick Cavett Show for a 30-minute interview of odd mannerisms, short answers, incessant coke sniffles, and uncomfortable silence.
Welcome, nice to see you.
Thank you.
So a lot of the glitter is gone that we associate with you, and you've got an entirely new person now.
Where no, you haven't.
Où sont les glitz de yesteryear, or something like that. Is the offstage Bowie likely to surprise people? I have had the weirdest reactions from people who know you're going to be on. Some of them say they'd be scared to sit and talk with you. Some people said you would bite my neck. Very peculiar kind of thing.
Which what you want, really, isn't it? And what do you think I'm like?
Well, I've only met you over the phone and a little bit backstage, and to me you seemed like, I hope this doesn't insult you, a working actor.
That's right, that's very good.
I mean, what are you drawing?
It's therapeutic.
Does this make you nervous to sit without your band and with everything and just to chat? A little bit.
Let's carry on talking. Don't ask me that.
Otherwise,
I'll wonder. I'd rather not know if I'm nervous.
I won't worry about that.
Okay.
Cavett would later say of the interview, quote, he was very wired. Either that, or he has a severe sinus problem. Bowie returned to New York in January to put the finishing touches on Young Americans. Finally having a moment to relax and take stock of everything, he had the shocking realization that the massive wealth he assumed he had accumulated was non-existent. He soon discovered that over the past 2 years, most of his earnings had been used to pay back the ongoing advances DeFries had been securing for RCA Records. Here's backup singer Robin Clark discussing how hurt he was by the discovery.
I think it was a big slap in the face for him because, you know, you look back and you see the body of your work, and at some point you want to see how much money you've made from that body of work, and there was nothing there for him.
David believed that him and DeFreeze were partners in Main Man, but DeFreeze revealed to him that he alone was the owner of the label. Here's photographer Mick Rock describing how DeFreeze had been able to swindle Bowie of his earnings.
David's, because his brain wasn't there. His brain was, you know, the big picture, the stardom, the moving the culture. But obviously the chickens came home to roost at a certain point.
At the age of 27, David Bowie was addicted to cocaine, disconnected from his family, and flat broke. In a twist of fate, he had become the fallen rock star that he had once created in Ziggy Stardust. The fall and rise of David Bowie on the next Year of the Bowie.